This is second to the last class, and we're looking at Srimad Bhagavatam 111. We've been going over. Today's class, we're going to talk about these lines, Muyanti Yatsurayaha Tejo Vari Midam Yatha Vinimayo Yatra Tri Sargum Rasha. The actual idea begins with Muyanti Yatsurayaha. So let's chant the verse. Everybody have it out. I got one to look at. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Yanmadhyasya yatum vayat itaratars charte shabhigyaswarat.
Yanmadhyasya yatum vayat.
Tene Brahma Vidaya Adi Kavaye Muyanti Yatsurayaha.
Tene Brahma Vidaya Adi Kavaye Muyanti Yatsurayaha.
Tejo Vari Mridam Yatha Vinimayo Yatra Tri Sargum Risha.
Tejo Vari Mridam Yatha Vinimayo Yatra Tri Sargum Risha.
Dhamna Svena Sada Nirasta Kuhakam Satyam Bharam Dhimahi.
Dhamna Svena Sada Nirasta Kuhakam Satyam Bharam Dhimahi.
Good. Starting to memorize it now. Hope it's coming out.
What about the English? I find the English tougher to memorize.
Well, I don't particularly care myself that the English is... I want the Sanskrit to be literal. The English, you know, I don't mind if it's, you know, one set of words or another set of words. Actually, we have two English translations here to begin with. So long as it's all there, the ideas...
We have all the nine.
You have all the nine elements in there, I'll be happy. So I'm not going to grade you on literally having the English right. The Sanskrit you should try to have right. You should try to know where the diacritical marks go and all that kind of stuff and not ignore them. But the English, it's not so necessary. So let's look. We're coming around now to this part here. Tejo, Muyanti Yatsurayaha. About whom demigods and sages are bewildered, either about whom or by whom. Yeah. There's a couple of readings of that yat. If we look at the word for word, that line, Muyanti Yatsuraya Tejovari Midam Yata. Vinimayo yatra tri sargum rasha. We look here, it is translated in the League of Devotees editions like this. Unto whom, it says, unto whom even the great sages and demigods become illusioned, as much as there is illusory representation of water in the fire or land on the water, and so on. It is on account of him only the temporary manifestation of the material universes made by the reaction of the three modes of material nature appear to be factual, although it is unreal. This unto him gets changed by the editors to by him. But in the word for word, that yat is given as about whom. About whom. Well, I think both senses must be there. They're illusioned about whom, and they're illusioned by him. Both, yat. By him, Even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representation of water seen in fire or land seen on water. Only because of him do the material universes temporarily manifested by the reaction of the three modes of material nature appear factual, although they are unreal. So obviously if it's just by him, you lose some of the sense of it, which is actually even the demigods and the sages make this mistake of taking the material world for being the ultimate reality. We'll talk about what that means. So Prabhupada discusses this section on page 8 here in the handout. And it begins in the middle of a paragraph, really. Srimad Bhagavatam is the narration of the Swarup of the Lord. You see that sentence on page 8? I'm going to read from the League of Devotees edition. I like it better. Srimad Bhagavatam is the narration of the Swarup of the Lord, manifested by his internal potency. What is meant by Swarup? The Swarup of the Lord?
The original form.
Yeah, his spiritual form. Swarup means his own proper form. Rupa means form and swa means own. So his own proper intrinsic, you could say, form. So Swarup means essential or proper or intrinsic. So as the narration of the Swarup of the Lord manifested by his internal potency. And this potency is distinguished from the external potency which has manifested the cosmic world which is practically within our experience. Srila Vyasadeva makes a clear distinction between the two in this shloka. Now this is where the lines we're looking at is where he makes the clear distinction. This first of yat surai muyanti yat suraiha tejo varim ridam yata vinimayo yatra tri sargom rsha is a description of the external potency. Then dhamna swena sada nirastakuhakam is a description of the internal potency. That's where it is. When Prabhupada says something like that in a purport, in this verse he has made a clear distinction. When you're reading a purport by Prabhupada, please go back and look and make sure you know what he's talking about. He doesn't say explicitly where it is. So you say, oh, where is that? And it takes a little study sometimes for it to be clear. But that's where it is. This is the external potency. And then here, dhamna svena sada narasta kuhakam. Because in the external potency, we're talking about people becoming illusioned. And in the internal potency, narasta kuhakam, illusion is absent. So illusion is present in the internal, in the external potency, but absent in the internal potency. So there's a distinction between the two in this shloka. So let's go on. He says herewith, he means Vyasadeva, that the manifestive situation of the internal potency is factual. What does manifestive mean? The manifestive situation. Why does he say manifestive situation of the internal potency? Anybody any ideas? It can be experienced. Sometimes the Lord is described as unmanifest, means not available to anybody's experience. But when Prabhupada used the word the manifested internal potency, that means what's manifested? Name, these things, name, form, quality, and lila, pastimes. Huh? Nama, rupa, guna, lila. With the lila are all his relationships. These are manifestive internal potency. And so, when he says manifestive situation, he means the whole display by which all these things about Krishna is out there. That's the manifestive internal potency. Dhamna svena sada narasta kuhakam. Whereas the external manifestive energy, that's also out there for looking at, inspection, in the form of material existence, is temporary and illusory, only like a mirage in the desert. Now, this mirage in the desert is a very familiar analogy, and but I don't want everybody to go to sleep because they've heard it so many times before. So let's take a fresh look at the idea. So what is that? By interaction of some other thing, there is the appearance of the water. So there is some arrangement by which in a desert water may appear. Usually, there, as I understand it, there's some body of water somewhere else, and by some refraction of light waves against the heat of the upper atmosphere, it's bounced. So there's like the upper atmosphere acts like a mirror and casts the image of the water on the earth. Something like that. Anyway, I should have looked it up in the encyclopedia before I came. I sound authoritative. But, so by the interaction of some other thing, there's no water there. It's heat and air and earth. That's all that's there. There's the appearance of the water. Real water is somewhere else, not where it appears. Similarly, the manifestive cosmic creation is appearing like some reality, but the, and here's this interesting expression which the editors got rid of because it's a little awkward English, but the real reality of which this is but an imitation shadow only. So here's two other words that are used to describe it. One is imitation, one is shadow. One, we have the concept of a mirage, the concept of an imitation, and the concept of a shadow. These are all obviously local examples to try to give us an idea of what's going on. And what's actually going on is a little difficult to comprehend. Similarly, the manifestive cosmic creation is appearing like some reality, but the real reality, of which this is but an imitation shadow only, somewhere else in the spiritual world, which is conspicuous by the absence of all affairs of the mirage. So that's where it's coming from. Then Prabhupada says, absolute truth is there and not here. That is to say, the absolute truth is manifested in the spiritual world, but is not manifested in the material world. Here, everything is relative truth, or one seeming truth depending on something else. Notice he now says seeming truth. It's not even really a truth. Relative depends on something else. We talked about that. One apparent fact depends on its another fact to be understood or for its existence, so they're relative. This cosmic creation is an interactory resultant of the three modes of nature,
That's three sarga here refers to the three modes of nature. Sarga means creation. The three creations, that is sattva, raja, and tamaguna. Everything you see is really derived from the mixture. The three modes are easy to understand in a very simple way. If you have to explain the three modes of nature to people, begin with something that's obvious to all of them. I took a lot of Hinduism courses and I never understood what was being talked about by the three modes of nature. They called them things like the three strands. Guna can be also like a rope or a strand. But I couldn't understand it until I actually read Prabhupada what was meant by three modes. But here you see, in the material world, you see that things are being created. Things are coming into being, being assembled out of parts. They last a while. The assemblage stays together. And then they fall apart. The assembly decays. Creation, maintenance, destruction. So things come together, they're created, they last for a while, they're maintained, and they dissolve, they fall apart. That's when things are coming together, being created, that is called Rajagun. Nature is in the mode of passion. When things are being maintained for a while, nature is in the mode of sattva, or goodness. And when things are falling apart, material nature is in the mode of ignorance or darkness, sometimes tamagun, darkness. It's very simple. Some people sometimes don't know is that this is very comprehensive, and also human mentalities can also be in the modes. When you're so lazy, you can't get off the sofa even to change the TV channel and sit up all night and stare at the test pattern, that is called the mode of ignorance. See, that is that behavior is behavior in the mode of ignorance, for example. Huh? Thank God for that has given a big boost for the mode of ignorance. But sometimes people don't want to push the button. Besides, they like the test pattern. and Bhagavad Gita describes the three different kinds of mentalities that are there in the different gunas. But notice the three modes, you see, what happens? The three modes are here in the material world. They're not in the spiritual world. The situation of the spiritual world is called Vishuddha Sattva. I wonder if I can walk over to the board here with this whole assemblage coming along after me. It's like a spacewalk or something. I don't know. The tape recorder is fine. It's the other thing. Why don't you flip it over there? Yeah, thank you. Okay. So here's Rajagun. Sattva. And Tama. Goodness, passion, and ignorance. So this is your cycle that's going on in the material world. Now, in the transcendental world, it's called Vishuddha Sattva. It's called Sattva because actually, it eternally exists. So therefore, it's sattva. Here in sattva, things exist. They stay together. So that sattva quality is something like the sattva quality in the spiritual world. Only in the spiritual world, there's no coming into being, and there's no going out of being. There's no raja, there's no tama. So wherever there's sattva here, it's bracketed and it's holding together some temporary construction. But here, the sattva is different. There's no tinge of raja and tama, and therefore there's no holding together of some temporary construction. It's a different sort of sattva. So it's called vishuddha sattva. It's sattva without any raja and without any tama. Now, of course, when there's increase of Krishna consciousness in human culture, there will be an increase in sattva, this material sattva, automatically. They're used to, everybody knows, Prabhupada says, formerly the advancement of human civilization was in terms of sattva guna. You're more advanced, the more the quality of sattva is being exhibited in human beings. Now, he says, the standard of advancement is rajaguna. So that's what you see. Like, for example, there's a common saying, they don't make things like they used to. Because once something was made, it would last and last and last. It was well made. That's a sattvic quality, that things endure for a long time. Now our civilization, even they have, you know, planned obsolescence built. You know, everything is temporary. You use it and you throw it away. So the result is there's a whole lot of things being created, whole lot of things being destroyed, and nothing is lasting. So that means the increase in passion and decrease in tamagun and decrease in sattva that we can see. That's what's happening in modern civilization. So we want to, Krishna consciousness will bring more and more sattva, and then finally to the Vishuddha sattva stage. So here's the difference between the material, where there's illusion. There's these temporary, everything is temporary. It has a beginning and it has an end. And when he says it is unreal, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It exists. Just like a mirage exists. The mirage exists. And it has this feeling, this existing quality because of the water which it reflects. This he explains here. This cosmic creation is an interactory result of the three modes of nature, and the temporary manifestations are so created to present an illusion of reality to the bewildered mind of the conditioned soul, appearing as so many species of life, including the higher demigods like Brahma, Indra, Chandra, etc. They're all caught up in this illusion. In fact, there is no reality in the manifestive world, but it appears so on account of the real reality in the spiritual world, where the personality of Godhead eternally exists with his transcendental paraphernalia. So let's look at this notion of illusion. What does it mean? It does not mean that it does not exist. But it exists with a misleading characteristic to it. This is the illusion, this Maya. And just like if you look at what is the misleading characteristic of a mirage? Well, you're in a desert and you're thirsty, and you see the mirage of water. It will never quench your thirst. That's the misleading characteristic. What quenches? Let's define water as that which quenches your thirst. By definition, that's what water is. It quenches your thirst. There it is. There's the water, but it won't quench your thirst. Therefore, it's not real. So in the same way, in the material world, these temporary products of material nature, they are bound up. You know, they're all limited little productions. They've got their little box around them of time and space. And therefore, because of that, they cannot give any value to the spirit soul. He tries to enjoy them. He tries to have a real life. in the material world and it doesn't work out. Because everything is temporary. Because when people go to material things for sense gratification, they really think what they're doing is going to save them. They think that what they're going to get is going to make them happy. They think that they'll achieve some wonderful, great thing. And they think it's somehow, it's here in the material. Maybe you have to look a little bit. But one day you'll find what you want. You know. And what do they want? They want happiness that lasts forever. They really do. You bring your senses into contact with sense objects, and some pleasure becomes manifest. In the course of time, because that contact between the senses and the sense object is unreal, it comes to an end. It comes to an end. And you're disappointed. You're let down. There was, a little bit of this, Raja had put it together and then stayed a while, and then the Tamagun came and it dissolved. The relationships dissolved. Right? This is the place of dissolving relationships. And so then there's disappointment. In fact, there's sadness. Why does a person feel sad or upset or even aggrieved, bereaved, bereft, goes into mourning, depending on the depth of the relationship, the intensity of the satisfaction, when it comes to an end, when the senses and the sense objects are separated? Why are they upset? Because they wanted the happiness of the pleasure they derived from that relationship to continue. Right? Of course. So then, say you're interviewing people. How long did you want it to continue? What are they going to say? Well, how long can I have? They want it to continue actually forever. That's what people are looking for. This is the mistake. We are eternal beings. We are looking for a relationship that will give us eternal pleasure, never come to an end. We are looking for that eternal relationship in a place where everything is temporary. Because we think we will find that in a place where everything is temporary, we are called bewildered, mujanti, vimudha. Means foolish. Like, the old story about the guy who's down the street corner looking, searching through the grass and everything. He said, "What are you looking for?" "Well, I dropped my keys." "Oh, let me help you look here." Do you know exactly where you dropped them?" "Well, I dropped them over by the door over there." "Well, why are you looking over here?" He said, "Well, here there's light." It won't help to look for it in the material. People are looking. And everybody knows, if you just take a really, just step back a little bit and look at what people want in the material world. And they want eternal happiness that will always go on. That's what everybody's looking for. And they're fighting like crazy. They're fighting like crazy. A parent has their children and they're doing like everything to keep it together. They're working so hard to maintain that relationship. They're working so they can have medical insurance so that in case the kid gets sick, they can save him from death. Everybody's working so hard just to keep these relationships going. Most relationships, the most fundamental ones, like the relationship people have with what they eat, where they live, all depends upon a steady flow of money. Everybody knows. No, it's not true that everybody knows, but anybody who's had any experience in the world understands that for there to be actual satisfaction of the senses, there has to be money. Only when people are very young do they think that they can do it without money, like hippies and things like that. They think you could have, and you can for a little while when you're young and your senses are so strong and powerful, you can have a little sense gratification without money. But then, you know, you start, and you know, you're young and good looking. It works out a little bit, but then you start to get a little old, and it's hard to find attractive sexual partners unless you have money, because money makes people immediately attractive. It's one of those things. And so on. It requires money. Sense gratification requires money. And then what people have to do to get the money is suffering. It is not sense gratification. It is just the opposite. They have to work so hard to get the money. And so they feel, they find out that to maintain their happiness, they have to suffer. And then when you get anything that's happy, that brings you happiness, immediately you're in anxiety. How long will it last? How can I keep it going? Is because everything, all the constructions are so unstable. Of course, then people decide, well, they retreat. You know, I'm going to get my happiness from art and music and all these other things. And it's true, those things last longer.
The whole human race is stark raving mad. Everyone is hell-bent on finding happiness in the material world. And yet, if you look and you can see, it's an historic failure. It's an historic failure. And yet everyone keeps on going. This is called being bewildered. You're in illusion about the world. You think there's real reality, that is real value, real truth, real substance in this world. And when you finally get to it, you know, it's just sand. It's just sand. That's the problem. Even the demigods, so smart, so intelligent, big sages, even they are bewildered. How can that be? Because Krishna bewilders them. Why does Krishna bewilder them? Because they want to be bewildered. Why does one want to be bewildered? Because one does not want to be in relationship with the absolute truth. To recognize the absolute truth, we have to take the position of servant. The point is that another aspect of this illusion, and the reason this illusion arises, is that one part of the illusion is that we see happiness or truth or value, truth, value, eternality. Notice people always think of eternality too in terms of this. Whenever they want pleasure, a German philosopher, Nietzsche, famous lines, Alle Lust will Ewigkeit, all joy wants eternity. And then in America, all our songs say, you know, I'll love you forever, our love will never die, you know, I'll love you till the end of time. Well, of course, you know, you won't. But everybody likes to say it, don't they? And try to believe it, you know. The other aspect of the illusion, and where the illusion arises, things, is seeing things separate from Krishna. That people are illusioned by Krishna. It's Krishna's illusory or deluding potency. And that potency itself is one of Krishna's energies. One of his energies means that it is related to Krishna, but the effect of the energy is you see nothing in relationship to Krishna. When you see things not in relationship to Krishna, then you see something that is, you see unreality. Absolute truth means everything is related to Krishna. You take any entity and you can follow it back, and there's Krishna. And a devotee is one who always sees the relationship to Krishna. Krishna is the owner, Krishna is the controller, Krishna is the enjoyer. It belongs to him. That's what it means to see things in relationship to Krishna. And I have to see also myself in relationship to Krishna. What is my relationship to Krishna? Servant. I have to be in that servant. When one doesn't want to be the servant, then he enters into this realm of unreality. See, I've made myself an illusion. I am not the servant of Krishna. I am not dependent upon the absolute truth. I am independent. Nobody can tell me what to do. There is no one greater than I. No one stronger than I. We have, in fact, declared war on God. This is the whole population of living entities in the material world are in this way psychologically damaged. The declared war on God. Who is their father? You notice in Freudian psychology there's this notion of the Oedipus complex, that the sons want to kill the father and possess the mother. Well, the original Oedipus complex is the father is Krishna and the mother is Krishna's energies. That's what Ravana wanted to do, right? He wanted to kill Ramachandra and enjoy Sita. So the living entities want to enjoy material nature as though they were God. She belongs to Krishna. Material nature is Krishna's energy. She belongs to Krishna. But we're thinking she's ours. When I want to dominate and control material nature in the mood of the enjoyer, I've alienated Krishna's nature from Krishna. Therefore, I get unreality. I can't actually do it. It can't be done because it's unreal. My attempts to play at God will not work because I am not God. The trouble with illusions is that ultimately they go away and you're faced with the reality. So all those who want to enjoy material nature become, I am the enjoyer, I am the controller, I am the possessor, I am perfect, powerful, happy, there is none greater than me, he is my enemy and I have destroyed him. You know, as Krishna does his job on the demons in the Bhagavad Gita, when that mentality is there, it's all illusion. And ultimately, your real position is revealed. And for the demons, that's revealed at the time of death. Krishna says, I am all-devouring death. That death is a representative of God for the materialistic person. That's when he bows down to the higher power, his subordinate, dependent, conditioned, non-absolute nature, is the reality is there. So Krishna consciousness is about coming to terms with reality. And the reality is we are, is constitutionally servant of Krishna. Constitutionally, you can't change it. When we set out to enjoy in this material world, we are denying what we are. We're denying what Krishna is. And therefore, unreal. Krishna delivers over us to unreality. And that's how the material world, then this whole illusion of the material world as a place of enjoyment, of sense gratification, arises. The essence of the material world is people are seeing things separately from Krishna. In the spiritual world, there's no prospect of seeing things separately from Krishna. The facility for illusion is not there. The spiritual world is the spiritual world because nobody forgets. Everyone is consciously and conscientiously the servant of Krishna. In the material world, everyone is also the servant of Krishna, but they're unconscious and unconscientious about it. Everyone serves Krishna no matter what, but in the material world, that service is, Prabhupada says, indirect and unfavorable. One last point is that if one becomes a devotee of Krishna, even in this material world, the material world becomes as good as the spiritual world. Actually, if we see everything in relationship to Krishna, then it's spiritual. But we cannot see anything in relationship to Krishna unless we use it in Krishna's service. Prabhupada says people want this pantheistic vision. They want to see, you know, everything in relationship to God, or everything as divine. In fact, everything is divine. It's true. But to see everything in relationship to God, we have to use everything in God's service. As soon as we are using it for our service, or with the notion that I am God and therefore I'm going to enjoy it, and isn't my enjoyment spiritual, then that's also Maya. Any notion like that. So if we want to see the reality, we have to see everything in relationship to Krishna. So in this way, that is how the material world is unreal. Ultimately, it's not unreal. Ultimately, everything is in relationship to Krishna. But there is a mirage, and that mirage is everybody running around trying to, you know, find heaven on earth. Or, as Prabhupada says, the kingdom of God without God. That's what they want. Yeah?
The Mayavadi's slogan, Brahma Satyam Jagam Mitya,
yeah.
The Mitya doesn't seem to be so much different than the unreal that we have in the slogan.
Yeah, because the Mayavadi's, what we've seen is there's, in this verse, the sloka, there's Krishna, represented as a circle, and then there's Krishna's energies emanating from him. Krishna and Krishna's energies. Now, what the Mayavad philosophy does, these energies are unreal, we say, because they are not seen for what they are, which is Krishna's energies. Right? But the energies are not denied. What the Mayavadi philosophy does is just erase the whole thing. God has no energies. The Absolute Truth has no energies. These energies don't exist. They don't. They actually end up denying janmadasyataha. He is one without a second, so how can there be anything for him to be related to? So if you understand the real reality, there's Ekam, Eva, Advatuya, one thing and one thing only, and that is the undifferentiated Brahman. And if you know that, then there's nothing else. The energies are just, they aren't there. Or they're almost not there. It's hard to get rid of them entirely. Because otherwise, what are you talking about to begin with? But so they put them in kind of an illusory... But the effect is to get rid of them. They deny the potencies. They're saying that God is impotent. The Absolute Truth is impotent, has no potencies. That's another Oedipal attack on Krishna. He has no potencies. So that's the difference. So that mitya for them, that unreal for them, means it just doesn't exist, or is close to not. We say it exists. But the mitya part is that it is temporary, and we take it temporary and of derived value, but we take it as, you know, the wonderful place where everything, if we just pulled it off, we could make it all eternal. And we did a little more science, a little more technology. That's the applied science and technology. Everyone's thinking, you know, that the supermarket tabloids, they always promise that medical product, you know, they're going to solve the problem of old age, you know. Yes, we've gone in there and we see that in every little cell there's a little, you know, chemical switch that's thrown, and that cell starts to get old, and we're going to figure out, we're just going to go right back in there and fit it back up. And you won't get old anymore. They're going to make this place an eternal place of bliss and knowledge, you know. What you've seen in history is the more you try to control material nature, actually the more deeply you become entangled. That's the history. But still, people are thinking, no, just more technology. More technology will solve the problem. So, did you have a question here, somebody? Do you have a question there?
I was going to ask you, one of the four principal verses in the Bhagavad Gita, in relation to what you're saying, that thing which is separate from Krishna is...
Yeah, know it to be whatever appears separately from me, know it to be to have no value. And it's like a reflection of light that appears in darkness. But we have to see everything in relationship to Krishna. That's Krishna's illusion. And even that potency comes from Krishna. Purcell?
Everything we have comes from Krishna in minute particles. Where does the serving propensity come from if Krishna's job is to be the enjoyer?
Where does the serving propensity come from?
Where does the serving propensity come from? Krishna's job is the enjoyer.
Oh, he also serves all the living entities as he enjoys, because he maintains them. Also, you're getting service from Krishna all the time, because that propensity is there. With Krishna, he expands himself into other living entities because he's magnanimous. You know, he just wants to increase. So there's other living entities, and then Krishna maintains them. So that's service also.
So even though he's
a supreme enjoyer, he's also rendering service. He also expands as Balaram, and then he serves Krishna. because Balaram is Krishna's, he provides his bedstead, his Anantashesha, and so many things. So it's all there. Yeah, David?
Just say a few words about this paradox where you mentioned that in the spiritual world nobody ever forgets their job. Mm-hmm. And yet we were originally our position.
Mm-hmm. I didn't say in the spiritual world nobody ever forgets their job. I said they're conscious and conscientious. By definition, that's true, because as soon as you aren't conscious and conscientious, you're not in the spiritual world. It's not that you're in the spiritual world and you fall into Maya and you get to stay for a few weeks before they kick you out, like it happens in the temples, you know? By definition, as soon as one has that notion, as Prabhupada said, and talking about that verse, Icha Dresha Samutena Dvanda Mahena Bharataha, all the living entities in the material world are covered by the dualities of desire and hate. Now, talking about this verse somewhere in the Bhagavatam, Krishna says, the original desire is, why can't I be God? And the original hate is, why should Krishna be God? Now, somehow or other, a living entity has the capacity to get that. We just have to accept that we have that capacity. Even though we know who Krishna is, we're in relationship to him, somehow or other, that capacity is there. How is it there? Here's where the idea of things happen without a cause has an application. That's called the activity of free will. When you actually make a free choice, it means that it's your choice. It can't be, if it's free, it doesn't mean it was caused by your past psychological conditioning or the modes of material nature, all the things. It's a free choice. The agent is you chose. So if we're free, our freedom is we can serve Krishna or not serve Krishna. That's our choice. It's not Krishna's choice. It's not anything else. So somehow or other, we have that mysterious capacity to say, one day, why should he be God? Why can't I be God? We're out of the spiritual world. You just instantly, you're in Maya. That means you're not, the spiritual world is a nice place because those people aren't there. They're all here, which is making trouble for each other. Because then as soon as you get a whole bunch of people, all of who want to be the supreme, obviously only some can be the supreme while others have to be subordinate. And so they're continuously hassling. Like that game, King of the Mountain. I'm God. No, you're the servant. No, you're the servant. I'm God. You know. They're all trying to enlist each other in their pastimes as the servant. Well, this is what happens. So somehow or other, because that choice is there, and you always have that choice, when as soon as that choice is made, then Krishna puts you in illusion. You want to forget Krishna. How can you possibly do that? Krishna gives you the power to forget him. Just as when we finally want to remember Krishna, he gives us the power to remember. Either way, he does it. But what we can do is just make the sheer naked choice. Okay? That's the best I can explain. Yeah?
When you were saying how the Mayavadi deny Krishna's energies and they accept Krishna, but isn't it that they don't accept Krishna and that they just accept the unmanifest form of the energy?
When they deny that the Absolute Truth has energies. Now, when you have the Absolute Truth without energies, then it's no longer a person. Prabhupada says, you know, our philosophy, God is a person, means the Absolute Truth has energies. That's what this is about. That's what we're talking about today, about the energies of the Absolute Truth. He has potencies. He's potent. What about the Atlas guy?
But then there's the planet that he's holding up.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't have anything to do with it.
Well, that there's some person somewhere.
No, that's nothing to do with the person. That's just to show that Krishna's not struggling to hold up the planets. It's easy for him. Not that there's a person somewhere. They deny the person. They deny the energies too. Goes along with it. They deny the energies. Okay. That's one last question, Purcell.
We always have free will. What's to stop us from falling back down into illusion once we get back to the world? The Krishna promises that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, he says you don't have to come back. You would hope that you haven't gone once. And you remember. It's not that you go back to the spiritual world and you don't know. You remember. You know everything. You remember.
And that's what stops you from making the same place?
I would hope so. Okay. It's time to stop now and have a feast. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.